this on.
Okay, good morning, everyone. It's always wonderful to be back, and I thank Ellie and the other people who are involved in organizing the Shiurim and Bezrat Hashem, the program in all of its levels, should continue to be with Hatzlacha. I remember many, many years ago, the last time I read David Copperfield, which is not very recent, so Charles Dickens wrote a Hakdama, he wrote an introduction to David Copperfield, where he says, every parent, although they say they love all children equally, every parent has a secret love, that perhaps there's a child they have a special love for, and I'm not saying whether that's true or not, and he said that David Copperfield was his secret love, wasn't so secret, of all of the novels that he wrote. Well, that just reminded me of something, that for many, many people, we're supposed to value all the Rishonim equally, Rashi, Ritva, Rashba, etc., Rambam, but for many, many people, Ramban is that a secret to child, not child, but the secret gadol, the secret Rishon, that people have a tremendous love and affection for. And in fact, none other than Rav Soloveitchik himself, Rav Soloveitchik, Brisker, a person who, and Briskers devote their whole lives to explication of the Rambam, actually stated that although most of his career, most of his teaching involves explaining the Rambam, but in point of fact, the Ramban probably had a greater influence on the development of Judaism as we know it than even Maimonides. Now, some people might consider that to be negative because the Rambam was an extreme rationalist, etc. And as you know, Judaism didn't turn out to be a rationalist religion so much because of the influence of Kabbalah and the like. And that development, although it was greatly accelerated by the Arizal and his followers much later, but it essentially started with the Ramban. The Ramban kind of veered Judaism away from the Maimonides Mahalach. Again, you can like that or dislike that, but nevertheless, it is a fact that the Judaism as we know it is much more connected to Ramban in many ways than even the Rambam. But be it as it may, the Ramban is a nature that you also cannot help loving because he was gentle, non-combative, conciliatory, respectful even against adversaries and the like. And of course, the Ramban has a very unusual zika, an unusual connection to Eretz Yisrael. Now, the particular subject that we're going to be talking about, although I probably will not get into it today because today will be a nature of an introduction, is a very, very famous event in the life of the Ramban, and this has been memorialized in popular culture in a number of ways, through movies and plays and books, etc., and it is known as the Disputation at Barcelona, or Vikuach HaRamban. And we have different versions of the story, and the stories are very different. We have the Ramban's version of the story, and we have the Christian write-up of the story. And as you might expect, the journalistic accounts are actually significantly different as to who emerged victorious. You know, we have our version, and the other side has its version. This was a very unusual debate in many, many ways. The other side of the debate was actually a Jewish person, an apostate Jew, Pablo Cristiani, obviously Cristiani was an assumed name, who became a Dominican friar, and the Ramban refers to him, perhaps somewhat derogatorily, as Friar Paul. That's how he refers to him as. And it was a little bit of a bizarre debate for the following reason. I'll tell you why it's a little bit of a bizarre debate. It was not debating the ultimate truths of propositions. Rather, Pablo Cristiani took a very bizarre position that the rabbis of the Talmud themselves believed that Jesus was the Messiah, was the Mashiach. And as a result, he is using Talmudic proofs to bolster the case of Christianity. Not just biblical proofs, using Talmudic proofs with kind of the bizarre assertion that the rabbis themselves acknowledge this truth. Why are you, Nachmanides, why are you, the Jewish people, denying it? So a lot of the debate simply involves the Ramban offering the proper interpretation of Midrash and Agada. It's a very strange debate because it's presupposing the authoritative nature of Jewish texts and then trying to use them to bolster the case for Christianity as opposed to simply saying, no, these are the Pharisees, these are the bad guys, you know, they don't mean anything etc. It's kind of the opposite of accusing the Jews of murdering Yashka. This is exactly the opposite. This is, hey, the Jews accepted Yashka. Why don't you accept? Again, that's kind of a bizarre, there's a bizarre logic permeating this, but we will get into that in more detail. But in order to put all of this in perspective, I do want to talk a little bit about the Ramban's biography, some of the highlights of his life, taking us to the Vikuach, and even the aftermath. Again, just to give you the date, the Vikuach was in 1263, and the Ramban died in 1270. So this is towards the end of the Ramban's life. The Ramban was born in 1193. He died in 1270, so he was 77 years old. His life, unlike that of Maimonides, was relatively peaceful, tranquil, and uneventful till the very end. The very end, there were quite a few jolts post-disputation of Barcelona, but the Ramban was able to live a life of relative calm, relative peace. According to many historians, he actually was also a physician by trade, similar to the Rambam, but at a very young age, he became known as a tremendous a scholar, a Talmud Chacham, a master of both Halacha and Kabbalah, which was unusual, again, as Maimonides generally either was not connected to Kabbalah or Maimonides actively disdained it. Now, there's a Baba Maisa tradition that Hasidim preserved, but it's really a Baba Maisa, that towards the end of his life, the Rambam learned Kabbalah, and the Rambam said, oh, if I just would have had this wisdom early on, I would have changed everything I ever did. But that I think is fairly clear to be a Baba Maisa, and there's no credence to that. The Rambam's whole rationalistic bent was very, very opposed to many, many Kabbalistic ideas. The Ramban, on the other hand, although the Ramban was also a philosopher, the Ramban was familiar and connected to various rationalist traditions of Rav Sadia Gaon and the like. He was aware of them, and he studied them, and he valued them, and he valued the writings of the Rambam as well, including the philosophical ones. But the Rambam was also deeply influenced by Kabbalah. Now, we're not giving a course in Kabbalah now, and in either event, I'm not a tremendous expert in it. I mean, let me point out that this is obviously pre-Lurianic Kabbalah. It is even pre-Cordovarian Kabbalah. So what form Kabbalah took, because Kabbalah has come down to us largely via the Ari and the Talmidei Ari. This is much, much earlier. And in fact, depending on what position you take about the Zohar, you know, is the Zohar Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, or is the Zohar Moshe Di Leoven? If you assume the latter, Ramban wouldn't have had access even to the Zohar HaKadosh. So we're not going to get into any detail what Kabbalah was the Ramban involved in, but it's very, very clear that the Ramban was a Mekubal. Let me just give you a few important dates in the Ramban's career. In 1238, when the Ramban was 44 years old, he was asked by the rabbis in Provence, in France, to get involved in resolving what has become known as the Maimonides controversy. And this goes back to the idea, the Rambam had already died, this goes back to the idea that many of the Rambam's works were highly controversial in Jewish communities. The primary culprit was the Mora Nebuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, which was the Rambam's attempt to integrate Aristotelian philosophy with received tradition. And when Aristotle is wrong, he's wrong, but the Rambam tries to show a path for those who are Navuch, those who are confused, and his audience were basically people who were very familiar with philosophy, which in those days meant Aristotle, as mediated through Arabic translations. Very few Jews read Greek or Latin. And the Rambam tried to create a reconciliation and a balance and a harmonization. There were many traditional rabbis, particularly in the communities of France and Germany, who were very perturbed by this opening up of the doors of secular, godless, atheistic philosophies. And they really felt that this was doing a disservice to Am Yisrael, and it might impugn the emunah pshuta, the perfect faith that a Jew is supposed to have. And as a result, there were many Jewish communities that actually banned the Guide to the Perplexed. They declared a cheirem on it. And that ban was extended to the first four chapters of the Rambam's great code of Jewish law. See, the Rambam had such a fondness for philosophical explication that even in his legal code, the Mishneh Torah, he managed to stick it in. For example, if you look at the first four chapters of Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, the Rambam called it the laws of the foundation of the Torah. This is four chapters of Aristotelian philosophy. There's not a single source in Chazal to anything he said, except for the fact that there's one God, but then he goes into describing the spheres and everything else. So the Rambam managed to kind of shtup in Aristotelian philosophy, even in the Mishneh Torah, at least for the first four chapters. So as a result, the ban in many communities encompassed both the Mora Nevuchim and the first four chapters of the Mishneh Torah. Now, there was a secondary controversy, which was much less intense, and although it is significant for the Shulchan Aruch even later, and that is, some were against the halachic codification of Maimonides, because Maimonides gives no sources, and he actually writes that the reason why he called his book Mishneh Torah, which means the repetition of the Torah, is because he said, all you need is a chumash for the written Torah, and my code for the oral law, I've codified all the rules of the oral law, you don't need anything else. Well, some people suspected, including the Ravid, that Maimonides is basically saying, don't bother learning Gemara, learn Chumash, learn my code, and then learn philosophy, and that should occupy your time. So there was a whole concept. The Ravid himself, in the Hasagos of the Ravid on the Mishneh Torah, writes that who does Maimonides think he is, who does the Rambam think he is, to simply tell me what the halacha is without giving me sources, without giving me reasons, without giving me any type of explanation of how he came to that conclusion. Why should I or anybody else accept his decision as to what the halacha is? Now that, I say, was a secondary controversy, because that didn't result in cheirim or the like, but there were people who were very highly critical of even the codification. Now, contrary to popular opinion, you'll sometimes read that there were Jewish communities that organized burnings of the Rambam's writing. It's important to be melamed l'kaf sechutz that, as far as I know, no Jewish communities burnt the books. What happened was that the Catholic Church, always eager to seize on any opportunity to take the Torah away from the Jewish people, took the position, like they're doing the Jews a favor, oh, if you consider these books heretical, then we will burn them for you. So the actual book burnings of the Rambam's Kesavim were organized by the Catholic Church. Now, were there some zealous Jews who got involved? Well, yeah. I mean, you know, and if you want to know, are there such people in the world? Well, yeah, look, go a few blocks away and you will find them. And those people, if they would have been alive then, might have been people who actively burnt the Rambam's books. But as far as we know, this primarily came from the Catholic Church, but it was triggered by the various charamot that were issued by Jewish communities. Now, Rambam was asked to get involved, because this was a controversy that was tearing Europe. The more rational rabbis and scholars of Sepharad of Spain were very, very appreciative of the Rambam's approach, and they thought that that was the way to go. The more conservative rabbis of France and Germany, Provence, were split in different directions. Some were absolutely against it. They thought this was apikores, kefira. Others were willing to go with it. The Ramban was asked at the age of 44 to try to make a compromise. That already shows you, obviously, he must have been a figure of some renown to be asked to step in to an international controversy. And the Ramban, as I say, was a very conciliatory person, besides his immense scholarship, tried to split the difference. But of course, as the Kutzker Rebbe used to say, people who try to walk in the middle get hit by traffic coming in both directions. And that kind of is what happened to the Ramban. The Ramban tried to say, well, the Rambam is great, and the Rambam is a tzaddik, and the Rambam is righteous, and the Rambam is filled with Yirat Hashem, and everything he writes is worthy of consideration. But perhaps our youth should not be exposed to these ideas until they have satiated themselves with Talmud learning, and the like, and therefore he recommended age limits that, not 40, 40 was for Kabbalah, but until someone reaches a certain level of maturity and proficiency. And he said, well, listen, the Rambam is indeed meeting the needs of a certain audience, he said, but perhaps this would be counterproductive to a different audience, meaning to say, for those who already were steeped in Greek philosophy, they need a Jewish response. But for those who were never exposed to it, why open it up? By the way, this is exactly the kind of the position in yeshivot to this very day. I don't know about this Beis Medrash, I haven't looked, but if you go to a typical yeshiva Beis Medrash and you ask where are the Rambam's writings, so they'll point to a shelf, then you say, I don't see the Mor Nebuchadnezzar on the shelf. So, oh, we don't have the Mor Nebuchadnezzar on the shelf. We have it either under lock and key or in another room. No, that's an exaggeration, but it's in another room. It's not going to be in the main Beis Medrash. And the concept is, well, if you need it, you can look at it, but it's not for the average guy. So the Ramban tried to make a compromise here. And again, this is exemplary of kind of the reasoned, conciliatory, split-the-difference type of person he generally was. Again, I don't mean that derogatory in any derogatory way at all, God forbid. But as I say, that didn't satisfy either side, and the controversy kept on building up. But it didn't last that long. I mean, it lasted another 20, 30 years, and then eventually it kind of died down. But let me just go back a little bit. This was in 1238. Now, I want to go forward with an event that was not in Ramban's community, but it was in Ramban's lifetime. In 1244, okay, this was 6 years after the Ramban tried to make a compromise, and the Eish HaMachloket did not subside. In 1244, the Catholic Church burnt 24 wagon loads of manuscript Gemaras, Talmud. And you have to remember, this is pre-printing, and all you had were manuscripts. Imagine how big a wagon is. 24 wagon loads were virtually all of the Talmuds that existed in the entire country. And if you have a good liturgical memory from Tisha B'Av, you may recall that one of the keynotes, towards the end of the keynote, was written by Rabbi Meir of Rottenburg, the Gadol Hador in Germany, whose life overlapped with the Ramban, and it's Sha'ali Suchufa Me'esh. In other words, it's a parallel structure to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's much earlier keynote, Tzion Halo Tishali L'Shlom HaSirayach. People don't always make the connection, but it is actually an imitation of style of that keynote, although Maran Berg was not a poet of the level of Yehuda Halevi. And that is, in Yehuda Halevi, his poetic conceit is that Zion, Sion, Yerushalayim, should cry out to Hashem to bring the Jewish people back home. Right? That's Yehuda Halevi. Sion, halo tishali, lishlom asirayach. Rav Meir Mirottenberg uses the Torah as his object. Sha'ali Suhufa Meyesh, you that have been burnt with fire, Sha'ali, ask God to show mercy on the Jewish people and the Torah. And in fact, if you sit down, if you have time, and you look at the two keynotes, you will actually see a very interesting parallel structure. And this was a keynote that the Maharam Mirottenberg wrote to commemorate the tragedy of the Sreifat HaTalmud. But what's interesting is that among a number of the Gedolim of the time, they came to the belief that the burning of the Talmud in 1244 was a divine punishment for the burning of the Rambam's books that were occasioned by the Charamot several years earlier. And indeed, in some ways, if we can talk about a silver lining in this very dark cloud, that was the event that kind of took away the Maimonides controversy, because they came to understand that it is not for us to attack the greatness of the Rambam and to disregard his works. In fact, the Chidar records a story, we don't know if it's 100% true, that Rabbeinu Yona, who was the Ramban's cousin, Rabbeinu Yonah wrote a famous book, of course, one of the great classic books on repentance, called Sharei Tshuva. And the Chidar records that Rabbeinu Yonah in his youth was a rabble-rouser against the Rambam, and after the Shreifat HaTalmud, he realized that this was a great sin, and he resolved to do tshuva by teaching the world about the idea of tshuva, and it is recorded that he wanted to go to the Rambam's kever in Tveria, travel from Spain to Eretz Yisrael to ask mechila, because that is the halacha that the Rambam himself records, that if you have hurt someone and that person has died, you take a minyan, you go with nine other people to the person's grave, and you ask mechila. But that's why we have the custom to this very day that when we're at a levaya, we ask mechila, because that you have your minyan. That's the most obvious, easiest time to do it. But unfortunately, Rabbeinu Yonah died before he got to Eretz Yisrael. He died on the way to Eretz Yisrael. So he never made it. So once again, therefore, the 1238, had there been the 1238 B'Shacha of the Ramban, perhaps there would not have been the 1244 burning of the 24 wagon loads of Talmud. So that was maybe the first major public issue that the Ramban was involved in. The next one was something that we'll be talking about in most detail, 1263, which is the disputation at Barcelona. In those days, remember, this was not the first Jewish-Christian disputation. This was commonly done in the Middle Ages. This is the most famous, and this probably had the most eminent Jewish scholar defending the Jewish position. But this was not the first, nor was it the last. This was a common feature of medieval debate. And this was a bit of a precarious experience for the Jew, because here's the problem. The problem is you get burnt on either way. Because if you lose the debate because your arguments are seen wanting, then God forbid, you may affect even other Jews who say, hey, Judaism doesn't hold water compared to Christian theology. If, however, you're too victorious, you can get in a lot of trouble too, because you are defaming the church. So essentially, the Jewish spokespeople had to be both scholarly, knowledgeable, and very diplomatic and alike. In fact, the Ramban had to negotiate. When the Ramban was summoned, right, Pablo Christianity went to the Dominicans, and they went to King James of Aragon, and King James summoned Ramban to debate with Pablo Christiani. The Ramban was astute enough to ask for a royal guarantee of freedom of speech. The Ramban had to say, I need to know that I'm not going to get arrested because I said something that's considered to be negative. And the king, at least initially, did grant him freedom of speech, meaning immunity, we would call it, meaning you can say what you want, and we're not going to kill you or arrest you for whatever you say in the course of the debate. Lahavdil, it is similar to the U.S. Constitution that basically says a senator or a representative cannot be prosecuted for anything that they say on the floor of Congress. Now, it's interesting, just to show you how these things can be very technical. When the Ramban wrote up the debate afterwards and restated his arguments, and that was circulated, they did arrest him because they said, hey, we only exempted you for what you said in the debate, but now that you're republicizing it outside, yeah, all right. But again, I'm getting a little ahead of myself in that way. The debate occurred in over 4 days. They were spaced over 3 weeks, but it was only four or maybe five sessions. And at the end, people voted as to who was the better debater. And King James said the following statement, I have never heard such a good defense of something that, of course, is not true. But he really made a lot of sense. He says, even though obviously it's totally not true. The Ramban records that the king even gave him a gift of 300, whatever the currency was, as a sign of affection and the like. Now, immediately, the fake news, as Donald Trump likes to say, started publicizing a lot of stories. They said, oh, the reason the debate was only four sessions is because Ramban chickened out and tried to escape the country. In reality, the debate was four sessions because the Dominicans asked the king, let's cut this short already. It's not going the way we want it to go. So that's why it was actually a truncated debate. It never really ended. In fact, the Ramban's account of the whole debate is only 6 pages. I mean, depending on the printing, it's not a huge book. Clearly, a lot of issues were not explored, and the Dominicans had a write-up that it was because the Ramban chickened out. But in reality, it's because they just asked the king to cut it short. It's not going in the right. Direction. So the Ramban was adjudicated the victor of the debate. But, as I say, that's the good news. The bad news was that, particularly after he wrote up the account of the debate for circulation among Jews, he wrote it in Hebrew. He did not write it necessarily for the Christian population. He was brought up on charges of discrediting or defaming the Catholic Church. Initially, King James imposed a punishment. Well, initially he didn't want to punish him at all. He said, listen, I promised the guy freedom of speech, you know, I mean, and if all he's doing is writing what he said, then, you know, why should I punish him? But the Dominicans pushed and pushed. So King James pronounced a sentence of 2 years of banishment and exile. That was not sufficient. They kept on pushing and pushing and pushing. So eventually, with some reluctance, the king ordered that the Ramban be banished from Spain. Now remember, the Ramban is not a young man. This is already 1267. The last 3 years of his life. So the legal proceedings took a few years. So as I say, if you think about it just from a purely human standpoint, the Ramban had a life that, Baruch Hashem, was largely tranquil and peaceful. And kind of towards the end, things are turbulent. All of a sudden, he's ordered to leave the country, and he was considered to be really the Gadol Hador in many, many ways. But in 1267, he left Spain, and he decided to go to Eretz Yisrael. In other words, the concept is that if he has to leave the country that he lived in, he might as well go to Israel. Now, I'm not going to talk about it today. I'll probably talk about it next week in a little more length. You know, there is a famous machlokas between the Rambam, Maimonides, and Ramban, if living in the land of Eretz Yisrael is a positive mitzvah of the Torah. Rambam does not count it, although there's a lot of debate, what are the implications? All I can tell you for sure right now is, in the Rambam's list of mitzvot, it does not say Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Now again, does that mean there isn't a mitzvah, or there is a mitzvah and it's not listed? We'll talk about that a little later, but it's not listed. That much is definitive. Ramban famously declares that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah min haTorah, and he emphasizes, don't think only when there's a Beis HaMikdash or whatever it is, b'chol eis u'b'chol sha'ah afilu bizman hazeh. This is the Ramban's position. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah d'oraita. Do we paskin like the Ramban, or do we paskin like the Rambam? Okay, it's a machlokas, as I say. Different people say different things. But the Ramban, surely paskin like the Ramban. And the big question is, why did the Ramban not go to Eretz Yisrael until he was kicked out of Spain? Meaning to say, he was already towards the end of his life. He gets kicked out of Spain, so finally, well, I might as well go to Israel. I mean, the Ramban is the one that says, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is mitzvah min haTorah b'chol eis, b'chol sha'ah, right? There seems to be a major inconsistency. And the Ramban did not write those words after he got to Eretz Yisrael. We know from the dating, this isn't the Sefer HaMitzvot. He wrote it much, much earlier. So the answer is we don't know. We really don't know what was the Ramban's thinking. There are two primary hypotheses that are suggested. One was that in those days, the trip itself was considered to be a life-threatening trip. We don't really realize. Today, you know, we feel bad because a 10 or 12-hour El Al flight is just excruciating, which it is, indeed. But one cannot compare 12 hours of being fairly uncomfortable with a journey that could take months and months through deserts in which there were wild animals, there were pirates, there were bandits, there were, you know, people who really would try to kill you and rob you. So possibly the Ramban held that it was a matter of pikuach nefesh, And although Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah, one is not mechuyav to endanger their lives, except in the context of war. That's a separate thing. When there's mechemet mitzvah, so obviously you have to endanger your life. There's no such thing as, well, I'm exempt from the mitzvah of war because war is dangerous. I mean, that's not a... The Minchas Chinuch already points out that that's a non sequitur. But as a general rule, in terms of my chovah personally to live in the land of Israel, pikuach nefesh is a heter. Now, people abuse that heter because people will say, even in America, oh, I can't move to Israel because it's too dangerous to live in Israel. Well, I tell you, it's much more dangerous to live in America. Unfortunately, things happen, and we pray, and we hope, and we're mispalel that there should not be any pegoyim, any types of... But in terms of overall, you know, where in the United States can you walk out and walk around outside at 12 midnight in my neighborhood? I don't know why the kids are walking around at 12 midnight, but I see 8-year-old kids walking around at night. And, you know, so Baruch Hashem, certainly you can't just invoke Bikuach Nefesh. Okay, but the Ramban perhaps could have invoked it. The second possibility is that the Ramban really was, not, it's not a fake title, Ramban Shel Kol Bnei Agolah, he was the leader of the Jews of Europe. He was the Gadol Hador, certainly after the Rambam died. He was regarded as the Gadol Hador. And particularly in days when there was no email, no faxes, no telephones, he needed to be in a place where he was accessible because there were relatively few Jews in the land of Israel. And as a result, he was mevater on Yishuv Eretz Yisrael for the benefit of Zikoy HaRabim. Now, to a much lesser degree, this is such a halakhic heter even bisman hazeh. This is what you might call the rabbinical heter, in which a rabbi of a kehillah might not make aliyah because the kehillah needs him. Now here, though, one has to be realistic, because what do they say? I once heard a very eminent rabbi say he didn't like to go on vacation because he was afraid of two things. One thing is the congregation may fall apart. The other is they'll do great. So he said, either thing worries him, because if they do great without him, that's also a little bad. So a rabbi has to realize that not all of us are indispensable at all times, but some rabbis really are. Some rabbis have created communities, particularly rabbis that have kind of made them balei tshuva, in which their presence is so critical that they will be told by people who live in Eretz Yisrael, who live in Eretz Yisrael, that they have a chiyuv to remain in the Gola. So again, we don't know for sure. Perhaps that was the Ramban's shikul. A more modern example, not that modern, but 20th century example, was the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim desperately wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael. And there was a delegation of great, great Gedolim that said, you're not allowed to leave. We need you here. Now, he was going to go anyway. And the story goes that the day before their trip, the Rebbetzin broke her leg. They had to stay for a while. And by the time she was ready to go, he was too old and sick to go. So, min hashamayim, he was kept where he was. So that's a little story about the Ramban. Now, once the Ramban comes to Eretz Yisrael, what does he find? Remember, these are the last 3 years of his life. He comes to Yerushalayim. And of course, he prays at the Kotel HaMaravi. What was the Kotel then? It did not look like the plaza now. The Kotel was a wall, because there had been garbage for centuries, that was maybe 5 feet above the ground level. And he prayed there, and he talked at the Kotel. But he writes in a letter that he sent to his family in Spain, famous letter. This is not the Igeret Ramban, that's another letter. But he wrote that the more holy the place, the more shemama, the more desolate it is. He could not find a minyan of Jews in Yerushalayim. There were not 10 Jews in Yerushalayim. There was not a Sefer Torah. He had to import a Sefer Torah from Hebron, and he got a number of Jews together to make a minyan. He established the Beit Knesset, which to this day is the oldest continuous Beit Knesset, the Beit Knesset HaRamban, not the one in Katzimon, the one in the old city. And although the building is certainly not the building of the Ramban, but the site, the actual location, is the Beit Knesset of the Ramban. In the land of Israel, the Ramban composed, or at least finalized, maybe the greatest of his Sforim, the commentary of the Ramban al HaTorah. And of course, one of the, there are many, many characteristics of this commentary that make it so outstanding and fundamental, but one of the great characteristics is the love of Eretz Yisrael that emerges thematically from many, many of his discussions in the Chumash. And in fact, the Ramban even took advantage of what you might call amateur archaeology, because there's a machlokas. We know that when there was a Beis HaMikdash, every year you had to give a half shekel towards the korbanot of the Beis HaMikdash. And the half shekel is a certain weight of silver. It's a certain weight of silver. And there's a machlokas, Rashi and Tosfos, as to what is the weight of the half shekel. Now, neither Rashi nor the Balei Tosfos ever saw a half shekel, and they're trying to figure it out from various Talmudic texts. But the Ramban writes, when I came to Eretz Yisrael, I encountered an Arab who actually had old coins dating back from the second Beit HaMikdash, and I bought some half shekel pieces that were actually given, and I weighed them very, very carefully, and I took into account, you know, metal getting worn away and the like. And the Ramban came to the conclusion that Rashi was correct, that although Rashi had never seen a half shekel, but the Ruach HaKodesh or whatever it is, and the Ramban is actually machria in the mach, because the reason it's relevant is because the weight of a half shekel will indirectly have an effect on Pidyon HaBen in terms of the coin. So you needed to know the value, not the value as much, the weight, the silver weight of the half shekel. And the Ramban is machriya lahalacha, according to Rashi, based on the realia of buying a coin from an Arab. He actually records that. But now the Ramban did not stay in Yerushalayim because there were very few Jews in Yerushalayim. So he moved to where there were a lot of Jews. And in those days, the largest Jewish settlement in Eretz Yisrael was Akka. Now Akka was not a very Jewish city today. But that was, because again, it goes back to the idea that certain parts of the land were controlled by Muslims and certain parts were controlled by the Crusaders. And you really have to have a scorecard, because there were times in which it was easier to live under Christians than Muslims, and there were times that it was easier to live under Muslims than Christians. So Jews were going back and forth. But at this time in the Ramban, Akka was the big Jewish community, because around 100 years before, 300 of the Balei HaTosfos from France had emigrated to Eretz Yisrael, and they were in Akko. And in Akko, we actually have, the Ramban was honored to speak on Rosh Hashanah, one of the last Rosh Hashanahs of his life, and the Ramban gave us later a written transcript of Drashat HaRamban al Rosh Hashanah, and that was given in Akko. Now, as a former synagogue rabbi, I'm always interested in what is the length of a drasha here, because, you know, the typical attention span is between 15 and 20 minutes. If you do more than that, you're in big trouble. Now, when I look at the Ramban's transcript, assuming that he said what he wrote down, because he says, this is what I said, it would have taken at least 2 hours. So either people had much better attention spans in those days, or when the Ramban is speaking, you know, your attention span gets a little better. This drasha, Rosh Hashanah, is a tour de force. It really is a magnificent drasha, because it really puts in everything. It puts in technical halacha, it puts in history, it puts in explaining of psukim, it puts in Kabbalah, it puts in inspiration and chizuk. In other words, you can't identify it as a single type of theme, because he really tells you everything you want to know about Rosh Hashanah, both philosophically, kabbalistically, halachically, and even with historical vignettes from his own life, going back to his childhood and the like. He recounts various machloksim, right? People fight over, you know, these fights and shows in the Ramban's time also, he says. One time a Batokeya blew the shofar, And there was a big debate among the different rabbis as to whether it was kosher or not. And the Ramban recounts the arguments, the Yaldusay, that when he was a child, he probably was a teenager, the different arguments that were being advanced. So that was the drasha of the Ramban in Akko. And then what happened was that he died. Obviously, he's buried in Eretz Yisrael, but strangely enough, it's very, very bizarre. The Rambam, as we know, died in Mitzrayim. But we know that the Rambam is buried in Tveria. Now, why the Rambam is buried in Tveria is not so obvious, because if you're going from Egypt up the coast, Tveria is not the first place you would get to. Now, Yerushalayim, you'd have to go inland, that's true, but nevertheless, Yerushalayim would be much closer. Again, there are legends, there are stories that there was a wagon drawn by oxen that was carrying the Rambam's tomb, and or the coffin, rather, and the oxen refused to stop till they got to Tveria. You just couldn't stop them, that they were but shared somehow. But some say that it's connected mystically to the idea that Tveria was the place of the last Sanhedrin, because after the Churban, the Sanhedrin went north in many, many ways, and the Rambam was considered to be connected to the ultimate codifier of the oral law, part of the Masorah of the Sanhedrin, and therefore Min HaShamayim, he should be buried where the last Sanhedrin was. But strangely enough, although we know where the kever of the Rambam is, everyone knows that, the Ramban, who lived in Eretz Yisrael and certainly died in Eretz Yisrael, we don't know for sure where he's buried. There's still machlokes, different opinions. Some say in Akko, some say in Yerushalayim, some say in various other places. It's a very strange thing that when we've identified, of course, not the identification is not always true anyway, but we've identified so many kivrei tzaddikim, there is still to this day not a definitive identification of the kever of the Ramban. Again, different tour guides will tell you different things, but we really don't know. Again, perhaps it's characteristic of the Ramban's modesty, his humility, and maybe his similarity to his namesake, Moshe, Lo Yada Ish Es Kavura So Ad Hayom Hazeh. Right, so that's kind of the highlights of the Ramban's life. By the way, he did have a Spanish name. His name was, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, Bonastura Saporta. And that actually means good fortune at the gate. Oh. Mazel tov at the gate. And I don't know how you got that from Moshe Ben Maimon, but this is the name by which he is known in the official records of the Bikkur HaRamban. And it is recorded that this is even how the Jewish population referred to him. They called him Rabbi Banastru, which is a nice way. In other words, the rabbi of good fortune, that's actually a nice way of referring to him, because he was very, very beloved. Now, one needs to know that the Ramban had, as I said before, a tremendous impact on future generations. First of all, the Ramban permanently redefined the nature of Talmudic study. Well, let me explain why. The Ramban was the first major person who integrated Ashkenazic limud with Sephardic limud. Right, the Ashkenazic centers of Torah were in France and Germany, and the Sephardic traditions were in Spain and North Africa. And each of them had great, great gedolim, right? The Rambam, Sephardic, earlier than the Rambam, the Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, in Fez, etc., Rav Meir Halevi, these were great, Rabbeinu Chananel in North Africa, right? We call that the Sephardim, as it were. And then the Ashkenazim, you had Rabbeinu Gershom, I'm being very selective here, Rabbeinu Gershom, you had Rashi, you have the Balei HaTosfos, etc. And because of the geographical separation, they developed, all of them had the Talmud, mainly the Babylonian Talmud. Now, one interesting difference is the Sephardim used the Jerusalem Talmud much more than the Ashkenazim. Rashi very rarely refers to the Talmud Yerushalmi. Sometimes he does, but it's been posited he did not have a complete manuscript of the Talmud Yerushalmi. We have to realize, before printing, what you had was very precarious. On the other hand, if you look at Ramban, you will see in all of these Sfardim, they use the Yerushalmi much, much more than the Bavli. Of course, that creates a little bit of a paradox, because the paradox is, many historians say that the Shorish of many Ashkenazi Minhagim are from the Yerushalmi, and the Shorish of Minhagei Sfarad are from the Bavli. Now, to me, this sounds like a little bit of a contradiction, because on one hand, you're telling me the Minhagim and the practices of Ashkenaz come from Eretz Yisrael, and the Minhagim and the practices of Sfarad come from Bavel, but on the academic level of literary sources, the Sfardim use the Talmud Yerushalmi much more than the Ashkenazim. That's an interesting little paradox that one could ponder. In other words, the Ashkenazim did not base their Minhagim on the Talmud Yerushalmi, they just based it on the practices of Eretz Yisrael that were brought to Ashkenaz through Italy. Eretz Yisrael, Italy, France, Germany, etc. And that brought the Minhagim of Eretz Yisrael. But be it as it may, there were two different Jerachim of learning. And let me summarize it. This is obviously an oversimplification. In Sfarad, the Derech of Limud was focused on simply trying to explain the Gemara text and to draw halachic conclusions, but it was not necessarily interested in reconciling different parts of the Talmud. Sometimes, you know, there are contradictions in the Gemara. And the Sfard approach simply was, okay, it's a machlokas between Gemaras. In other words, we don't have to reconcile anything. This Gemara says this, this Gemara says this. So we simply have to figure out which one should we follow and then explain it to the best way possible. For example, if you look at the responsa of the Rambam, again, in the Mishnah Torah, he doesn't tell you how he reaches his conclusions. But in the responsa of the Rambam, when people say, how do you reconcile this Gemara with this Gemara? The Ramban would say, these two Gemaras take different positions, but I follow this one because of A, B, C, and D. There was no hechrich, there was no compulsion that you have to reconcile and synthesize. You simply have to choose which is the more authoritative text. Now in Ashkenaz, a very, very different mahalach was created. And by the way, this actually does correspond with scholasticism in France. If you go over the medieval university, I mean, I don't want to say the Balei HaTosfos were copying the methodologies of medieval universities, but there are very, very strong parallels. And that is the concept of the dialectic. You take contradictions, and what you then try to do is you try to reconcile them by drawing distinctions. Now, sometimes that means by saying that this text is talking about a particular case as opposed to something general, and therefore it doesn't conflict. So all sorts of subtleties were introduced, subtleties and distinctions in order to create harmonization. And this was the shita that was created and popularized by the schools of the Tosfos, right? What does Tosfos literally mean? Additions. Because Rashi was the basic commentary, and the Balei HaTosfos would write these additional notes. The founders of the Balei HaTosfos were actually Rashi's own grandchildren, Rabbeinu Tam, but actually the Balei HaTosfos were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. And they developed great subtlety and acumen in distinguishing things that look like contradictions and the like. This was a certain analytical approach to learning. So the Sfardim had their way, and the Ashkenazim had their way, and the two ways were not even familiar to each other. The Ramban, and this is an enormously important contribution, brought the Mahalech of the Balei HaTosfos, because the Ramban had studied for a while in Provence, in part of France, which had that methodology, and the Ramban brought it to Spain, and from Spain it went to North Africa. But the Ramban did not abandon the Sephardic emphasis on Pshat and on Halacha Lamasa. So the Ramban's enormous contribution to Talmudic learning, which from the Ramban's time became a permanent feature, was the integration of the analytical methods of the Balei HaTosfos with the emphasis on Halacha Lamasa and Pshat that emerged from the Sfardim. Okay, so one has to remember this was actually pivotal. And the Ramban's disciples continued this. Rav Shlomo ben Aderes, the Rashba. And the Rashba's disciple is the Ritva, Rabbi Yomtov ben Avram of Seville. And the Ritva's disciple was the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissen. I don't know if all of you know these names, but this is the pantheon. This is the pantheon of the advanced learning in any yeshiva. These are the Rishonim we study, and this is basically because the Ramban synthesized these two different Jerachim, these two different Mahalchim. So one has to recognize the enormous contribution the Ramban made to the study of Gemara, bringing it to a new level of depth. And to this day, the Ramban's Chidushei HaRamban, his Navole, his insights, which are not on every Maseches and not on every Daf, are considered to be, you know, jewels of depth and acumen. The Ramban writes in a very, very brief style. He's brevity. So one has to work to try to understand what he's saying, but there are so many riches under there. The second thing, the impact of the Ramban on the study of Chumash. The Ramban's commentary on the Chumash, at a minimum, is the second greatest commentary ever written. You know, often Rashi is assigned the highest. Ramban is absolutely number two, at least. And some people will put it either number one or at least equal. That's not for me to decide. I can tell you that the Ramban's sense of textuality was so acute that virtually every single Sefer on Chumash that has ever been written since the Ramban is essentially dealing with questions the Ramban raises. People give different answers, but the Ramban was the one who identified everything. Like any question, why does the text say this instead of this? Ramban got it. Ramban honed in on it. And therefore, the Ramban's textual sensitivity was extraordinary. But in that textuality, he weaves in the oral law, the Torah Shebaal Peh, with the Torah Shebichsav. In his commentary, we have textual problems, we have linguistic problems, we have halachic issues that he discusses, we have philosophical issues, and finally, we have Kabbalah. Now, the Ramban writes in the introduction to his commentary on Chumash that whenever he's going to mention Kabbalah, he's going to introduce it with a code word, Al Derech HaEmes, the pathway of truth. And then the Ramban says, whenever you see those words, you are to stop reading unless you have been initiated in this mystical teaching. It's not for you. It reminds me a little bit, somebody told me, I never checked this out, that Satmar has a website. I'm not sure if this is true, but they say Satmar has a website. And when you log on to the website, the first thing you get is a Yiddish page. And the Yiddish page says, if you can read this, get off. Meaning they have it in English for the outsider, but if you're a Hasidic kid that can read Yiddish, you know, get off the website. You know, so it's kind of, the Ramban says, I'm giving you a signal that this is where you are to stop reading Al Derech Emes. So the Parish on Chumash is really a magnificent source, not only of textual analysis, but of really fundamental Jewish philosophy. The philosophy of a Jew, whether it's Abbas Yisrael, Abbas Torah, Eretz Yisrael, all of this is in the Ramban. And the major philosophical problems of free will and God's knowledge of the future, whatever you want to, whatever problem you identify, the Ramban addresses. So his impact on the learning of Chumash and Jewish philosophy was quite amazing as well. And as I say, his influence continues to this very day. So next week we'll talk about the Vikuach in a bit more detail. As I say, it is only a 6-page Vikuach, and it's a bit of a bizarre type of argumentation on the part of the non-Jew, on the part of the Jewish apostate, because the Jewish apostate is making what is prima facie a very preposterous claim that the rabbis of the Talmud themselves considered Jesus to be the Mashiach. That's kind of a loser to begin with, but we'll talk about what the Ramban does with that. So have a good week.